He entered a world where fantasy is real, where he could be anything he wanted, and where he would discover the most dangerous temptation of all.
Come and get me, boys. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. I believe you were expecting me.
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
This is the podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve to have an absinthe-inspired, hallucinogenic trip. Joining us once again is good friend of the podcast, Katie Patterson. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm recovering from watching Annette.
Spoilers.
Ahead of ourselves there.
And how did you get here, Katie?
I had a really romantic encounter with Charlie on the train. He texted me to see if I wanted walking from the station. And then I was like, I think we must be on the same train. And we like leapt down the long overground train and walked towards each other.
Did you break out into song?
Yes.
Yeah, obviously.
Okay. This is also the first episode we're recording after it was universally acclaimed that All Quiet on the Western Front was the most important film of 2022.
In Britain.
In very specifically, in Britain. We love war. All right, so with that, let's move on to the film of the day, Moulin Rouge, 2001 jukebox musical directed by Baz Luhrmann. A celebration of love and creative inspiration takes place in the infamous, gaudy, and glamorous Parisian nightclub at the cusp of the 20th century. Christian, a young poet, fuckboy, who is plunged into the heady world of the Moulin Rouge, begins a passionate affair with Satine, the club's most notorious and beautiful star. So, Moulin Rouge, who wants to start?
I love this film.
Yeah?
With my whole heart.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite films in the world. It always makes me happy. I appreciate maybe the ending shouldn't, but I love this film.
What about you, Francesco?
Ewan McGregor is a fuckboy, isn't he?
He's such a fuckboy in this film.
But he's a goof. It's a nice fuckboy. Is there a word for a nice fuckboy?
No, a soft boy?
I don't know what he is.
A soft boy's worse.
Yeah.
Because it's a fuckboy who's like in disguise.
But he is a soft boy. But that's
like,
what he is.
Sad little me. But that is what he is. Yeah. But it's just not better.
He's a bit of a shit by the end.
He's a soft boy, for sure.
I've heard someone make the point that he is the Duke if the Duke had no money. His morals aren't better, he just has less power. And I don't know if I agree with that, but I thought I'd throw that out to you straight off the bat.
Interesting. I think I'm trying to imagine the Duke without power. I mean, his whole vibe is just power. It's quite hard to imagine. Christian does have like some imagination. And like he's got something about him besides jealousy. That's why the jealousy taking hold is kind of
crazy
to the plot.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you've been corrupted by something.
I don't mean crazy in an inorganic way, but it's very like intense when it happens.
As the Argentinian says, jealousy will drive you mad.
Yeah, but to give my actual comment on the film, I wish there were more musicals where...
Me too.
Yeah,
where the soundtrack is just a collection of pop songs from the era.
I hate to break this to you.
Oh, have I got a franchise to tell you about?
No.
They're very common.
Jukebox musicals, they're usually just music by one artist. It's not medleys of...
Sometimes. Rock of Ages.
Motown musical. Yeah. Anne Juliet.
Oh, is Anne Juliet that?
Yes.
But that's only on stage, isn't it?
Well, to be fair, it's Max Martin, but they're all recorded by different artists originally. Uh-huh. Yes, for now it is on stage.
Yeah.
But also the Sing franchise, Trolls.
The Sing franchise. I take back what I said.
Oh my God, Shrek. When that gorilla sings, I'm still standing at the piano. I mean, Shrek.
Shrek, it's background
Shrek
music
too.
Though, it's not...
No, the characters don't sing it.
They sing I'm a Believer.
Yeah, and also in the special DVD extras.
This is a huge tangent, I'm going to cut it off.
Okay, but keep you cutting it off because I think it was funny. But like, I'm glad you cut it off there. But yeah, they're very. I know what you're saying. But it's usually around like a theme.
Yeah.
Whereas this is just hits of
whatever song is going to work best for this moment.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you like all the song choices in this movie?
Do you know it's actually really hard to tell because I'm so familiar with it. I think I do. And I think that because I don't like them in the adaptation back onto the stage, where they just, there's like 17 additional songs thrown into each number, and it just makes me want to scream.
You've seen the stage play?
I have listened to the soundtrack of the stage version, and I hated it.
Really?
I hated it with so much of my being. Like the Elephant Love medley, already an awful lot of songs, they put like 15 more songs in there, and it just becomes unbearable. It's just silly. And God knows we can't have silliness in an adaptation of the Moulin Rouge. It's such not at all silly, but it's too silly. There's a line up to which silliness is good, and there's a line past it where
I'm
no longer, yeah. Exactly, it just becomes annoying. I watched this film when I was definitely too young to watch this film, but it's also got such a kind of a Bollywood spectacle approach that I do think the kind of the adult content is not as off-putting as it might
be. The interesting thing about that, and just for clarity, we try not to say Bollywood on this podcast because a lot of people within the Hindi film industry don't like being defined by Western cinema, and it also implies that it takes all of Indian cinema, whereas it's a very multifaceted cultural landscape.
But also, like, a lot of the tendencies that we talk about that clearly inspired Moulin Rouge aren't unique to Bollywood. They're also unique to other kinds of Indian cinema.
It's musicals,
but
yeah, Baz Luhrmann was, like,
but Baz Luhrmann was
particularly
watching Bollywood.
But he's very explicit that that's... Yeah. I think he watched one Bollywood film. I was like, oh my God. This, we should do this.
No, he
that's
was.
What it sound, that's what it sounds like in
no,
the story
was,
that he tells
he
about
was
it.
He was in India to find like, inspiration for his production of Midsummer Night's Dream, I think.
He went to India to find inspiration.
Yeah, that's not a cliche. That sounds like something Christian would do. I was talking to Katie while rewatching this film, asking, is Moulin Rouge objectively the hottest Ewan McGregor?
Yes, because. Trainspotting, that's a no. I don't think the prequels or Star Wars give him enough material to be hot. I think he looks hot in those films. I just think the character is a bit too asexual.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the Jedi way, I suppose. But I actually had a focus group of three people, and two of them said Velvet Goldmine.
Oh, of course.
Which is a very fun choice. One of them said Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I personally think it's Shallow Grave.
I haven't seen Shallow Grave.
I think it is Moulin Rouge.
I think in both Velvet Goldmine, and if you will, in Trainspotting, is a type. He's the most objectively hot in Moulin Rouge.
I think he's the most accessibly hot in
accessibly,
Moulin Rouge.
That's the word.
Mainstream hotness.
He can be the romantic awakening of a lot of girls in primary school. Except they're probably not watching Moulin Rouge, come to think of it.
I mean, I was, and
yeah,
I wouldn't say that he was the romantic awakening in that film.
Who was?
Well, all of the very undressed women. So that's just a different issue.
But this movie was your awakening.
Oh my God. This film, like all of the good things, like this film is so hot. Like this is a sexy, sexy film.
It is a hot, sweaty movie.
In a way that doesn't feel, and still actually I think doesn't feel, exploitative in the way that makes you feel everyone had a bad time filming this. Obviously it's about exploitation and it's about sex workers and it's about, I'm not suggesting it's somehow like some utopian thing where all the women are really
well developed,
empowered and whatever, but there's something about the energy that they do have that it doesn't feel. There are films where I watch them now, even Chicago, where even just now 20 years on from first watching it and being like, oh my God, I'm a bit less. I'm a bit like, okay, does everyone need to be quite this exposed or like...
The horniness in Chicago is a bit lame.
Yeah, whereas the horniness in this film is like, I just absolutely believe it.
Because it feels so true. And it's because it's so specific.
Yeah, but it just feels like a little bit closer to Lady Gaga's kind of exhibitionism. It's not for the most mainstream possible gaze. It's still very sexy. It's still very exposed. It's still playing with very provocative imagery, but it just feels that little bit more like, no, this is still a bit for me and this is too complicated for you to masturbate to. I think that's the energy, basically.
Why would you masturbate to it? It could cut away at any moment. You find yourself staring at the Duke's face all of a sudden.
Or... if you get lucky, Jim Broadbent.
If you get lucky,
dressed like little bride, being flapped out with coats.
That might be my favourite number in the.
It's just the like absolute the ingenuity of that
lunacy.
Jim Broadbent performance. Just like the she's confessing. thing. Like, what's happening?
I just think it's the most brilliant inclusion of, like, a virgin that they could have included.
Yeah.
Because they could have given that to Satine and made it, like,
made
a
it
very sexy
gross.
Number.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sexy in the
But also,
way.
If
yeah.
Satine had done it, it would have been too, like, the Madonna version.
And she does Madonna. She does Material
exactly,
Girl. So.
Yeah.
But she does it in a very different way, whereas I can't think of the way that she could do like a virgin.
You couldn't have her do it with a straight face. That would be
exactly.
unbearable. But then
exactly.
why would you have her do it without a straight face when she's already done her whole shtick?
I think the best yeah. uses of popular songs in this film are the most imaginative reworkings of those songs in totally inappropriate ways.
The hills are alive. Do you know who plays Audrey in that first Bohemian scene?
Who?
It is fucking Faramir from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. David Frenham. Of course, it's a Baz Luhrmann film. Random Antipodeans are just everywhere. Dave Faramir is on stage, on screen for like 10 seconds in full face of makeup and a little like black fringy Edna Mode wig just to be like, and then flounce out. Goodbye.
People seem to like working with Baz Luhrmann.
It looks like it would be really fun.
What are your thoughts on Baz Luhrmann more generally?
I think it's fun.
Have you seen Romeo plus Juliet?
No.
Yeah. That's... I think this is the only Baz Luhrmann film I love. I think the others are all fine.
Yeah.
I have a soft spot for His Great Gatsby.
I think it's fine.
I think it's quite good. But that's
I
not...
just think it's fine.
I didn't...
I'll just keep saying it.
I think Elvis is fine.
I don't think any of these films are like, oh, this film's so awful, I can't watch it. I think they're all fine.
I know, because speaking about Elvis, now that we're on it, I think watching Elvis kind of showed me what I like about Moulin Rouge in a strange way. Moulin Rouge, the entire, at least the incipit of the plot, is about a revolution. A what revolution? A class revolution? No. A, like, any kind of revolution? No. They just want to write musicals and make popular music. And there's...
It's
there's
the swinging 60s.
Yeah.
Like
and there's,
in the 1890s.
There's this idea that the fact of making popular music and making entertainment is in and of itself revolutionary. And in Moulin Rouge, it doesn't go past that. It doesn't have any aspirations above that. But then in Elvis, they take that to make it seem like Elvis was somehow this bastion of like pro-civil rights, whereas he never was. It was just making music that was making conservatives upset. So it's just how unpretentious Moulin Rouge is compared to Elvis in the messaging that he's trying to send.
Christian, and we'll get onto Tick, Tick, Boom later, but Christian isn't necessarily... I think the other people he's with are more in line with the idea of the bohemian ideal. He kind of just wants to get laid.
He's literally a tourist. He's quite self-aware about it. They're all like, oh, you're so great. And he's like, God, and he's got this, you know, flashbacks to this like grey, grey, grey England and this grey, grey, grey father. And he's a bit like, maybe I don't have anything to say. Nothing's ever happened to me. Which I do prefer to people who are like, I am a profound artist and I have so much to say, but I just, no one wants to hear it. He's a bit like, I think I have stuff to say, but I'm worried I might be boring. It's like...
You are, but you're cute.
Yeah.
But do you think you'd enjoy the Moulin Rouge? As presented in this film, not the real
as
life
as presented
one.
In this film, well...
Just
especially,
like,
especially as a woman.
I like being there as the camera. I don't think I would like being there in person.
Just
but it's like, it's the difference between going into a strip club versus going to a burlesque show, right? Like, it always depends on how... where you think the power sits in the room. Like, I would never go into a strip club because I know where the power sits in that
and
room.
Apparently the food's terrible.
And I just feel like it's probably a lot of chicken and I'm a vegetarian. So,
exactly. Like,
whereas a burlesque show, you're seeing the same flesh, but like the power dynamics are so different and the production values are so different. So it would just depend if it's a Moulin Rouge burlesque spectacular where the power's in the right place or if it's just a strip club, but it's 1899, so they're wearing more to start with.
Well, I think in the film it's kind of in between, right? Because it's very elaborate burlesque numbers, and especially in the first number, she clearly has the power to command the room, but also every single patron is an old, wealthy guy. Like, it'd be surrounded by
and they're very explicitly full-service sex workers. Like, you can see them do their very skilled performance, but then you're allowed to pay for them to sleep with you, and the insinuation is that those women don't have much choice about taking or not taking on clients in that situation.
And so Satine only has any agency because of her success.
And that even she doesn't really have much.
Exactly.
As soon as she tries to say no, it turns out that she doesn't really have that option. Yeah, I like the fantasy version where none of that is actually happening because the sequences that are shot are the only sequences that are happening.
Have either of you guys seen Babylon?
No.
All right, then I won't talk about it. But it's kind of described as like, oh, the underworld of Paris. But like every like customer at the Moulin Rouge seems really rich and quite well to do. And it looks like quite...
That's what he says in his voiceover. He's like, this is where the rich and powerful come to play with the young and beautiful creatures of the underworld. The professionals are the underworld and the patrons are the rich. That's guess, like what he says.
I know. It's just, it's not like that seedy. It's like very high...
No, it's very musical theatre seedy. Like,
yeah, the people who think the Moulin Rouge is seedy should go to the Paradise. Because that thing is weird. People are getting murdered. There's a guy called Beef.
Yeah, a choice. You can choose whether to watch Satine perform or Beef perform. Who do you choose?
Beef,
of course.
He's a better singer. Should we put a pin in the Beef talk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's put the Beef away.
Put the Beef in the fridge.
Yeah. And then we'll just...
Oh god.
So Charlie, you mentioned your favorite number is Like a Virgin. Katie, favorite number?
Tango de Roxanne.
Oh yeah. My favorite number. What's the name of the number that they sing when they pitch the musical to the Duke?
Spectacular.
That's my favorite one.
That's so good. Yeah. Everything that happens in The Elephant is genius.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think of Come What May? Because it's the only fully original song.
I don't think it's the best number in that film. It doesn't transcend its surroundings at all. It's not like, oh, finally we're hearing music we don't know, which another version of the film, that number might do it. But I think it works perfectly. It does exactly what it's supposed to do.
I would argue what it's meant to do in the world of the film is transcend, because it's what brings them together in the final act. But I believe that the characters believe that it's truly... transcendent and profound, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's really important to them. But I watched this film when I was, I don't know, 8, and I just thought that was a song I didn't know. I didn't know lots of songs. I mostly only knew one Madonna album because my mum didn't want like pop culture to ruin us too much. So most songs were a surprise to me. So I just thought that was another song that I didn't know before the film.
I rewatched it when I was 27, and I thought there was a song I didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. So. Like, I think the original, as one of those sort of behind the scenes things where you're like, that's a fun thing to know, but when you just consume it, it doesn't really matter that that's the original song.
Nicole Kidman in this film.
Is there anything to say?
She's really good. She was nominated for an Oscar. She's great.
Yeah.
Absolutely stunning in every possible sense.
Is this the hottest Nicole
Triple
Kidman?
Triple threat. Yeah, surely. When they're like, oh my God, the most beautiful woman in the whole of Paris.
It has to be someone that looks like Nicole Kidman.
I absolutely believe you. I believe that this room of people who pay to look at beautiful women all the time are all like her. It's also a great moment in Moulin Rouge where I just was looking at my notes for anything I'd missed, and the Duke, when he's being really oblivious to their affair, is just like, look, my dear, a little frog.
He humanizes him so much.
He really thinks, once he's signed the he's just that like completely pathologically corrupted by money. He really thinks that because he bought her, that now they're in love and they're having a nice time.
As, yes, he's economically powerful, but doesn't fully understand how... It's not enough just to buy something. It's a continual thing. He is so oblivious to the needs of others outside of his position. It's not... This isn't that interesting.
So, yeah, if that's all, we can move on to availability.
Yeah. You can stream this on Disney+. You can rent it on Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Sky Store, Chili, Microsoft, YouTube, and our good old friend, Rakuten TV. We still don't know what that is. And you can buy it on all those channels as well. Play the trailer.
20th Century Fox presents Phantom of the Paradise, a gothic horror story.
What was that?
A beautiful love story. A cinematic odyssey through the rock universe. From Greece to glitter, wow! And beyond.
All right, now it's time to take the Beef out of the fridge. I don't think you expected it to be quite so dramatic. We all doing okay? Happy Pancake Day, everyone.
Oh my god.
I'm gonna have pancakes, yeah.
No, we will. Phantom of the Paradise is a rock opera directed by Brian De Palma in 1974 with music written by Paul Williams. And this rock opera hybrid of Phantom of the Opera and Faust fledgling singer-songwriter Winslow Leach finds himself double-crossed by the nefarious music producer Swan, who steals both his music and the girl Leach wants to sing it, Phoenix, for the grand opening of his rock palace, The Paradise. After Swan sends Leach to prison for trespassing, Leach endures a freak accident which leaves him disfigured and plans his revenge on both Swan and The Paradise, becoming the Phantom of The Paradise. This synopsis is bullshit. There's no beef.
No beef.
No beef.
Okay, Charlie, I think before we talk about anything else, I think you've just got to talk to us about beef.
Okay. Beef is the innocent victim of this film. He didn't do a single thing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He turns up to audition for this thing. He gets the job. It's a plum gig. Good for him. And you know what? You see him in rehearsals, and then when you actually see him on stage, he's absolutely killing it. However, the Phantom says, if you sing, I'll kill you. And then Beef, understanding that this is a real danger, tries to leave. And then Philbin gaslights him into thinking, oh, it was a drug-induced thing. You didn't actually see a phantom. Despite the fact that the Juicy Fruits were the victims of an attempted assassination earlier that week.
A successful assassination.
But you see them later in, like, bandages.
Okay, so it's like a cartoon explosion.
Exactly. Okay. That was my read of it.
That seemed to be the moment.
To be honest, I don't know how you can spoil this film considering it's based on, like, every horror.
It's based on Phantom of the Opera, Faust, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Those three are evident. What are the other ones?
Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And also There Are Shades of Frankenstein.
Yeah, so you know what happens.
You know what my favorite thing about Beef is?
What?
You know how he paints those little, like, doodles, like, next to his lip?
One is a Virgo sign.
Yeah.
One is a shamrock. Mm-hmm. And one is a gender fluid sign.
So when he's taking a shower and the Phantom comes in and terrifies him, he's got the gender fluid sign painted on. Between that and when he's leaving the theater, like one scene later, he's got a shamrock painted, implying that whilst rushing out of the theater under threat of murder, he repainted his makeup from scratch.
This is why Beef is amazing. Can we talk about the film?
Yeah. So I was aware of this film for a while and I wanted to watch it for a while because neither of you are familiar with this reference, but one of my favorite mangas, of which I have a panel tattooed on my flesh, is called Berserk. Now, anyone who's read Berserk will understand where I'm going with this, but I'm going to show Katie a picture of the main villain from Berserk.
Oh, I see, yes.
Yeah,
okay, I see.
So, it looks like the Phantom.
To think that this very gritty, serious adult manga, its author took inspiration from Phantom of the Paradise to design his main villain, fills me with such glee.
So is it fair to say we were all hit in the face by this film?
Yeah, I
was hit in the face by this film.
This is the first time I saw this film. I was at the Prince Charles Cinema all-nighter. It was the third film, so it was about 2-3 in the morning.
That is the right time.
To watch this for the first time.
Yeah.
It was the third film of the night, and honestly, I was blown away. However, I liked it more on this rewatch, and I think it is a stone-cold masterpiece.
I watched it as a double bill with Elvis.
Interesting.
That's good, actually.
I was quite out of energy after finishing Elvis, because the film is long, and this one brought me back.
It's a cinematic equivalent of an upper.
Yeah, speed.
Yeah. Oh, God, I don't know. This film, I love it so much. What do we think of it as a musical?
I think, what is a musical? Is this film a musical? I didn't feel like I was watching a musical.
Is it a rock opera?
More in its very obvious relationship with the musical version of Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
But in a way, I just felt like I was watching someone's really fun, farce, horror riff of that musical, less than like its own musical.
What do you think of the music?
Yeah, because I think we're entering into, like, is this film with cowboys and guns a Western?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not, I don't care. But
it's got music in it.
I can't remember any of the songs, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Really?
Yeah. I can remember what the songs look like. I remember the shots, but I really can't remember the songs. I remember Jessica Hopper's character, who's
Phoenix.
Phoenix. I remember her doing her number.
I remember pretty much all the songs in this. And yeah, they're all diegetic and they're all stylistically different. I think one of the reasons why the songs might not be that memorable is that the characters who would have like those big numbers in a musical, other than Phoenix, who is the ingenue, the Christine Phantom of the Opera reference that Katie looked at me approvingly about. As you know, I don't like Phantom of the Opera.
I also don't like Phantom of the Opera, but
it's a bit rubbish.
That's fine.
But anyway. But the thing is, like, Swan, despite being played by Paul Williams, who provides the singing voice for the Phantom, doesn't have a song.
No, because that would be weird. I mean...
But, like, would it? Because the villain songs are fun.
Well, villain
and villain songs are memorable.
Yeah, but this isn't a musical. But also...
Fine.
More serious. Isn't the whole point of Paul Williams' devil character that he's so nothing? That, like, he's this, like, utterly,
there's a huge, huge build-up.
Unremarkable, just guy.
Which is so much funnier when you realise his motivation was to stay beautiful forever.
Yeah. He's just like a Dorian Gray thing. Looking like this little kind of cherub who's just sort of... really ordinary, but quite young. I think it's too vulnerable for him to sing. It would undermine that strange mystique of, like, he looks so normal and underwhelming, and he's so scary because of how everyone responds to him.
And I suppose he doesn't need, like, the traditional, like, villain desire song, because he doesn't need to worry about desire, because he gets everything he wants, because he's that powerful. Conversely, the Phantom does have songs, but they're all quite mellow, and quite... the ones he sings are quite sad and quite...
and they're quite yearning, and it's...
Exactly. Yeah. And they're never the best part of a musical. Like, the Juicy Fruits were kind of the Greek chorus.
It's such a good name. It's such a funny name. I don't know why it's so funny.
For a 50s nostalgia
the
band.
The Juicy Fruits.
It's perfect. It's so good. And
that whole opening sequence with the Eddie song and the... oh, my God. I was writing out all kinds of stuff down, like the backup dances that they would do. It's just the Juicy Fruits.
But, like, they're kind of like... they're kind of the Greek chorus. Mm-hmm. And they have... I think they have some... really good songs, but again, they're not, like, the core characters. I think the most memorable character to song ratio is Beef.
But also the fact that Swan refuses to hire, to produce competent singers, it's actually that he hates perfection outside of himself, is what he says.
Doesn't make any sense.
Like, but just, like, him wanting to remain beautiful forever. Like, it's clearly sardonic.
It's like 4 foot tall.
Yes.
And that's coming from me.
But he's got a youthful face.
Wait, how old is Paul Williams?
I think he's like 32.
I think that makes it funnier. Like,
it does. No, that's what I'm saying. When he comes in like a puff of smoke and you think he's going to be like the devil and it's just Paul Williams in a suit. It's so funny.
In quite like a little, slightly butch middle-aged lady kind of suit. You know? Like, it's a really particular style he has, and it's very like somebody's aunt in the 70s.
It's based on, you know, Phil Spector.
No, I'm gonna look him up.
I don't know.
Because in the original script that Brian De Palma wrote, he was called Spectre, and he was based on Phil Spector, who actually turned out later to be a murderer.
Oh,
but
my God.
That wasn't known.
Famed as a producer and convicted murderer. Okay.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, I just think this film's great, and I think actually getting into depth about the plot is a bit redundant, but that hasn't stopped us.
But I think it's not... so, not unlike Moulin Rouge. It's like the...
the plot's 12 minutes long.
It's not that the plot is not... whatever, but the plot is not why we're here. Like, the film is not here being like, let me tell you this story that you've never seen before.
The film is 90%
vibes. It's all about
vibes.
The execution. It's all about the vibes. That obviously, there's some really dark things about, like, the treatment of women and about sexual assault and about the overtones of all of that, which obviously feel like just as significant a part of the, you know, the darkness the film is going for. It's all, they're wrapping it up. It's all the same. It's the exploitation is part of this. And he's literally the Satan figure. So it's not like they think that that's okay. But I don't know. What do you think about Jessica Harper's character, apart from Jessica Harper's general brilliance?
Someone would hate me saying that, but Jessica Harper is perfect.
She
admits that.
Even more perfect than Paul Williams.
Somehow. I think she's really good. I think it's a stock character in the sort of operatic fable. Type of story.
Fable-y.
Yeah. She's not particularly detailed and developed, but neither's Swan, neither Leech. The only character that really has interiority is Beef.
Yeah.
And I don't mean... that's not a bit.
No, I really also feel that way very strongly. Like, Beef feels like a real person. He's a particular person. But Beef, I'm like, I feel like I could meet Beef. None of these other people are real.
Is it more significant that she's the only main female character? Yeah, that makes it a bit of a shame, but I don't think it's a film that is all about these super complex male characters and she's caught in the middle, is what I'm saying.
No.
But I also think that Swan and the Phantom are both kind of static characters in a way. I mean, the Phantom grows progressively crazier, but it's not like he starts off, you know, in a good place. She goes through a huge character arc, but it's all done in the span of like 3 seconds because she's not the main focus of the film.
But that's kind of in the same way.
It's funny, like it makes sense as a satire.
But... It is, but also it's like about the way that Fame works in the world of this film is that she goes on stage for one song right after someone gets murdered and becomes an overnight sensation. And being an overnight sensation is introduced to the film in the first song about Eddie.
Yeah.
Sung by the Juicy Fruits.
The greatest band of all time.
The greatest 50s nostalgia band of all time, the Juicy Fruits, sing about, you know, becoming an overnight sensation and the potency of that. And so that happening, and then within seemingly like a day or a couple of days getting engaged to Swan, and Swan film basically controlling anyone she has access to.
Yeah.
It's like whisked to the ivory tower.
It's all totally fable-y and fairy tale-y.
Is it camp?
Yeah.
Yeah?
In a good way?
Yeah.
Good, nailed it.
I think it is because it's done with the wink. I don't think the character of the Phantom is very camp. But I think on the balance, the film just about lands its campness because there's enough of the knowingness. Because camp is not just about being about excess or about flamboyance. It's like it is very specific about there's a knowingness and a playfulness.
But he dresses in a costume, hides in the shadows and murders people in very inventive ways.
Yeah, like Batman. Not camp. Depends who's playing him.
We covered Batman and Robin on this podcast.
But Batman isn't camp.
No, that's true. Poison Ivy is camp.
Yeah.
And also Christian Bale camp, not camp.
You know who's camping?
No, tell me.
Starts with a B, ends with an if.
Beswan if. Bephoenix if.
It's beef.
Oh, beef!
It's beef. A lot of bird imagery in this film.
But also, all the major characters, all the major characters are named after some sort of beef, you know, obviously being a cow, and Winslow Leach, like, he's sort of the lowest in the food chain. But Swan and Phoenix, like... He's a swan, he's a bird. He's like the most elegant, but a phoenix is better than a swan.
And he hates perfection outside of himself, and that's the...
Haven't you ever played Leech Phoenix Swan?
What?
Swan beats Leech. Okay. Leech beats Phoenix. Phoenix beats Swan.
You've been watching The Big Bang Theory.
And whose fault that is, it's yours.
Why?
You brought Simon Helberg back into our lives.
Oh God, I forgot he's in The Big Bang Theory as well as Annette. Oh.
How could you possibly forget
that's
that?
That's what I knew.
That's why he's famous.
What did you think? Like, oh, it's the guy from Florence Foster Jenkins. Yeah. Oh, this movie.
Are we ready to...
I think so.
Talk about where this masterpiece is available to stream.
We can talk more about beef later.
Yeah.
And we will. Okay. You can rent this film on Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Chili, Microsoft, and YouTube. Rakuten, pull your fucking socks up. Where are you? Okay, should we descend further into mania?
I think we should, yeah.
Can we get much lower?
Oh boy, can we?
The man has changed me. What I see in her is obvious. What she sees in me is... it's a little more puzzling.
1, 2, 3, 4! So may we start.
Annette, a 2021 film directed by Leo Carrà. The story of Henry, a stand-up comedian with a fierce sense of humour, and Anne, a singer of international renown. In the spotlight, they are the perfect couple, healthy, happy, and glamorous. The birth of their first child, Annette, a mysterious girl with an exceptional destiny, will change their lives. Now, some housekeeping before we get started on this film. I'm a big fan of Leo Carax's previous work. This was not my favourite of his, especially in the first half, but It would be unfair to call this a Leo Carax film. This was conceived by the Sparks brothers, who also composed the music, and then Carax put his hands on the final draft of the screenplay. Secondly, this film is weird. Thirdly, please be nice to baby Annette. She is a baby after all. Now, thoughts?
I want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, me too.
Why did you pick this film?
Oh, okay, so I hadn't seen it. I wanted to watch it. So I put it on. I texted Charlie while watching it. I was like, I'm watching this film. I don't know if I'm going to pick it because I want to stick with it to see if I like it. And I ended up liking it by the end. There are so many weird similarities to Moulin Rouge in a way that makes this almost like its weird cousin, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's heavy use of CGI, backgrounds, and Baby Annette is a puppet. She's mostly a practically animated puppet, but there are scenes where she's a badly CGI animated puppet who's flying. That reminded me of Moulin Rouge a lot. The fact that this feels very self-aware, so basically, just to give you some more background, this film is functionally a parody of the rock opera genre, and it's almost entirely sung. Every line of sung dialogue is expository by design, which is poking fun at some of the conventions of musicals and rock operas.
Well, or opera specific, or opera more generally.
Yeah, exactly. So, by nature, every character is just wearing their heart on their sleeve and just expressing their and exposing their innermost thoughts at any given moment. And I thought that was very Moulin Rouge. Only Moulin Rouge does that through popular music, not through actual exposition.
The hills are alive!
And I just think there are so many like weird little similarities. I'll come up with more as we talk about it.
Oh, I have a list.
I've hardly spoken about the similarities between Moulin Rouge and Phantom because we would get so sidetracked by beef.
I distilled the essential tenets of all four of these films into a list. Sad boy just wants to share his art with the world. Behaves unreasonably towards impossibly beautiful lady. Impossibly beautiful lady sings. Illness as metaphor. Capitalism, bad. Death, the show must go on.
Yes.
That tracks.
Though, do you think Harry is more of a Christian character in this film? Because Harry isn't an idealist. He hates himself and is very self-commiserating and sad and bad.
He's very proactively trying to share his art with the world, though.
True.
And, like, if you have a dark reading of Christian, which I think I do more than Katie, I would argue he is a bit of a Christian if Christian had any power.
Christian, crucially, and these are all very fictional, fantastical worlds. Christian is a man in 1899, and Henry is supposed to be a man in, at the very least, the 21st century. So I'll give Christian just a tiny, tiny bit more leeway for being awful.
But I think the other thing is that Moulin Rouge doesn't frame Christian as awful, whereas Annette frames Henry as awful.
Yeah, literally calls him unlovable.
I guess the difference, I agree, that Moulin Rouge doesn't ever really frame Christian as in the wrong. And maybe, arguably, this film is like, wants to be framing Henry as in the wrong, but it's Henry's the only person this film is interested in at all.
I agree.
I think it totally gives the lie to being like, oh, it's about like, oh, but he's so terrible. And it's like, well, then why is he the only person that you're at all interested in?
And, well, this kind of gets into, because you prefer the second half of this film.
I think it's just more fun.
Yeah, it is more fun. The first 45 minutes I watched with my lovely boyfriend Sam, and it brought us back to a time when we watched Bo Burnham's Inside.
Well, it's kind of making fun of Bo Burnham, isn't it?
Heavily drawing on Bo Burnham. And we watched that, and Sam's like, I feel a bit just bad now. That was a bad time. And I was like, oh, it's okay, it's okay. And I put my hand on his shoulder, and our bed broke and crashed to the floor just as I was being like, don't worry, everything's fine. And I would say Annette evoked for us a very similar feeling of like, I don't know if anything will ever be fine again. After the first 45 minutes, we were pretty traumatized. So we stopped, and then I watched the rest of the film the next day, and it got like less difficult to watch.
The reason I prefer the first half is just that I know it's a big opera trope, but just woman dies and it's all about how the man feels about it. It's just so boring to me. Not that I think the film is boring, but I think that particular trope is boring. And I think the fact that that is how the film uses Marion Cotillard is such a waste.
kind of midway point of the film, spoilers, but we can't really not address this. She dies and comes back from the dead as a kind of a sea ghost.
As two sea ghosts.
And you don't really see much of her after that. And I was really hoping that, you know, ghost evil Marion Cotillard was going to have a part in the second half. And I was disappointed that
because alive Marion Cotillard didn't really have a part.
No.
So.
She's like, oh, I think my husband might be a bad dude. Oh, I'm dead. You're a bad dude.
So I think that's the key of this film, and that's why I don't love it, but I still like it. Not every film is to be, you know, a pleasant watch or a film about agreeable characters.
Like Beef.
Like Beef. However, you're right to say that, you know, the best films about narcissists also have an interesting supporting cast. And this film really doesn't. Other than the accompanist slash composer, who has my two favorite numbers in the whole film.
Which are?
The accompanist and the composer. Is that what they're called?
Like, I'm an accompanist. I'm a composer.
Yes.
No, I'm a conductor.
I'm a conductor. Oh, sorry, the conductor. Yeah.
But he is also a composer.
Yeah. Because he wrote their song.
Yeah.
So I have a fun piece of numbers. So Simon Helberg was paid in 2018 $23.5 million. Do you know what the budget for this film was?
Less than that.
It was less than that. It was about $15.5 million.
Because Adam Driver signed on to this before he became super famous.
Yeah.
I think he'd made Inside Llewyn Davis, but it was pre-Star Wars. Like, he was here, he was on it from the beginning. Like, imagine now his quote.
Because it got passed between directors, didn't it?
Yeah, because it was all about the Sparks Brothers. I don't know if it was passed between, but it was very much, he got involved, I think, before Carax was signed on to direct. I don't know if there was another director in the picture at one point.
Well, because I know there's an interesting quote by Carax, who's, all of his other films were made in France, and his star actor in every one of his films was Denis Lavan.
Who we've covered in Beau Travail.
In Beau Travail. And he said in an interview that he likes both Denis Lavan and Adam Driver because they remind him of monkeys. And I think that that's a great reason to have a star actor.
Have him literally played by a monkey at one point.
That's right.
And his stand-up act is the Ape of God.
Yeah.
The Ape of God, yeah. That's Carax's touch that was in the Sparks Brothers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not part of any of the songs.
But the Sparks Brothers wrote, like, the original screenplay was, like, fully written by them.
Sure, but but the point is, like, it's just a simple piece of dialogue where someone calls him the Ape of God.
Exactly. Carax isn't even credited as a writer, but I think he did put his hands on the screenplay here and there during production.
I know you said Bo Burnham, what Henry's vibe as a stand-up is.
And I think visually, the only references I got were to Bo Burnham and to Louis C.K.
I was thinking Louis C.K.
I was like, this film is a, like, what if we spent more time caring about Louis C.K.'s hurt feelings about losing some work for 10 minutes?
That's not how I read it. I don't think this film cares about his feelings.
I think this film fucking hates Harry.
Yeah. It makes him the focus, but it never makes him like, and at the end of the day, like, he's a monster. And he is painted as a monster that does terrible things that we won't spoil, but
he
has no redemption whatsoever. But I agree with Kate insofar as if you need to show truly how much you despise this character, you also have to have some form of a contrast on the other side. And the conductor is kind of that, but he's in way too little of the film to be that. Marion Cotillard could have been that, but she's a non-character. So I kind of agree that with that reading of, like, yes, this film is criticizing Henry, but also doesn't really care about anyone outside of him.
Yeah, and I think, okay, so I'm going to say it. I think if you're going to do such a relentless thing of, like, we're pastiching opera, like we're doing rock opera that's sort of playing with tropes of opera, well, the two main things about opera specifically, also about musicals, but really specifically about opera, is that you are in the room with someone displaying incredible technical skill to make nice sounds with their mouth.
But that's another here's another comparison to Moulin Rouge that I forgot about. None of the actors in here are musical theater actors. They're all,
but they're singing so badly, and I know they're all capable of singing better than that, so it's a directorial decision to make the sounds horrible.
And Marion Cotillard is actually dubbed by an opera singer.
Yeah, her opera sounds lovely, opera, but when she has to sing, like, in her character rather than in her opera voice, it speaks singing. I hate it. I really and truly, I hate it.
Yeah, and Adam Driver sounds great in Inside Llewyn Davis because he's singing in his range, he's singing in a bass baritone range. I think they're all able to sing.
Yeah. It's the same as they is. It's like, it's not their fault. I think they have the capacity. They're being directed to sing in this unbearable way.
With the caveat that in Les Mis, that's Hooper, who clearly doesn't know how to direct musical actors and wants to achieve some weird warped form of cinematic realism by making them sing in a setting that is not conducive to singing. Here it feels less like the actors were put through hell to give their performances. It feels more like the film is trying to purposely give an off-key, monotone, frustrating and uncomfortable sensation to the audience.
Well, it seems to have done that for Katie.
Yeah, it did that very, very well. Yeah. But why? Like, I really and truly don't understand.
I think this is probably my problem with the film. I think the film is really funny once you vibe with the humour. But it's a film that simultaneously critiques Henry for being someone who hates himself and his audience, but kind of extends that onto its own audience. So in a way behaves the same as the character that it's critiquing. If you take it at face value, if you just take it as funny and humorful, you know, the Sparx brothers, they're not the... I don't know if you ever saw any interviews with them. I don't think they've ever spoken a line seriously in front of a microphone ever. They're characters.
Well, they're not even called the Sparx brothers.
Yes, yeah.
It's exactly. Not their name.
Yeah, but, you know, they're comedic characters. So I think that's why it took me a while to vibe with this film. That's why I want to watch it again, because the humor started clicking with me all in the second half when we started seeing ghosts and puppet babies. And then I was like, okay, yeah, I get it. The first half where it's about, yeah, pastiches of stand-up comedians, that weird like Me Too dream sequence, it felt like it was trying to comment on the real world. And that just fell flat for me. But when it becomes more whimsical, I was like, okay, this is not about the real world. It's just really out there and funny.
And I did think with The Phantom that I was like, this sound designer hates me so much and is trying to make me peel my skin off. But that was very clear and intentional. And I was like,
you can vibe with people
are making choices to make me want to hate myself while I watch this film. That's fine. That's a completely valid choice to make. But it does bother me to an unreasonable extent, because basically I think is that Baz Luhrmann and Lin-Manuel Miranda and Jonathan Larson love musicals and they love opera and they love dancing and they are trying to do things differently and they are trying to be playful and they are trying to, you know, they're trying to do some subversion, they're trying to do some form changing, breaking, whatever. They're doing it from a place of, I think this is a great thing and I love it and I just want to play with it more. And I just felt like The Phantom and Annette, like, if you hate musicals, just, you don't have to make them. It's okay to just not make them. If you hate musicals and you hate opera, you could just make literally anything else in the whole world.
Do you think Paul Williams likes musicals?
I really don't know anything about Paul Williams. That's the main thing that Googling that film taught me. But I think there's much more care.
He wrote Bugsy Malone and he wrote The Muppet Movie and The Muppet Christmas Carol. It's a very De Palma film, but it's the soul is still Williams.
Yeah.
Here's why I don't think this film hates musicals. Because the Sparx brothers, they're big Hollywood cinephiles, they're big into genre films. I would find it hard to believe that they hate musicals, but they're also in the business of confusing the audience, I'm going to say, rather than frustrating the audience. However, this film hates Henry McHenry, and it's all about Harry McHenry. And it's all about punishing Harry McHenry. And by extension, you know, that bounces off onto the audience. You know, it feels like a stray bullet more so than the purpose of this film is to be completely unpleasant. Because if you want to find this film funny, you will find it really funny. Although I'll agree that it is a bit too long. It could have done with half an hour less and it would have achieved its purpose and probably been more bearable and less frustrating for a lot of people.
Absolutely, chunks of it that were really funny. She's just a baby. Like, sequence is genius.
Yeah.
Like, there was so much in the film. What I wanted, basically, was I wanted to have seen this film projected on the walls of a gallery and tuned into only the smallest number of moments of it, because it looked amazing. But I didn't feel like watching it like a film was the appropriate way to consume it. It just didn't feel like it was for that.
If the other characters, like Anne or the accompanist, which is how he's credited, so I'm just going to call him the accompanist, rather than just Simon Helberg. Do you think that if either of those characters had more interiority, you could get more, and you got more of a sense of how Henry is perceived through their eyes, so she's not just a victim and he's not just a simp, do you think that the film would be more bearable because you were able to actually have an audience surrogate and because you feel isolated because the only person you're able to identify with is so unpleasant, it means that you're watching these horrible things, but without any emotional involvement. Or any emotional involvement that you're allowed to have is extremely unpleasant.
I guess it's just, you know, there are some of the bits of the film that are so wonderful is when they're so surreal and so theatrical. like when they have this gorgeous like back projected waves, and then like I'm just like, it's stunning
when it's more like Moulin Rouge
when exactly,
and when it's not going for realism.
The stuff that I really liked was when it just was like, okay, we've got this wild, wild imagination and we're not particularly concerned with reality. And then they would do things like these songs that I hated.
We love each other so much.
Yeah.
And then like, it goes on.
I just wish that they had made those fun.
It's early in the film when Anne is giving birth. I think that sequence is really funny.
I just thought the music writing was so lazy. Like, not the orchestration, which was very accomplished.
You mean the lyrics?
But I mean, like, the lyrics and the vocal stuff that, like, you have one song which is just them saying we love each other so much over and over again. Okay, you've done that joke now. You can't do that for every other song in the whole piece.
I just think
they should have worked a bit harder, basically.
It's their first screenplay, first of all. It's their first venture into cinema. I think the parody, if you watch musicals, most songs are pure expositions of the character's innermost thoughts. But then you have parlato, like spoken dialogue bits in between that are actually where the plot progresses. This film removes that and it's just like people giving exposition. And yeah, you're right. It's funny at the beginning, but then it's kind of milked a bit too hard, which is why I think this film could be like, maybe not, you know, perfect film. It could be a great film for me if you trimmed it by half an hour.
Or an hour.
Or 2 hours.
Or 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah, lovely short film.
I really liked it. I think Katie and Francesco's debate over the merits or demerits of Annette is actually quite a good example of just the fact that this is a very strange, polarizing film.
Oh, I was telling Charlie.
So the Google reviews, like, fully, it's like, it's 5 stars, big, thick yellow bar, 1 star,
same
big,
with Letterboxd. Yeah.
Like
my Letterboxd is 4 stars.
People love it. People are like, this is, if you don't understand this film, it's because you're an idiot and this is a genius, blah, blah, blah. Or people are like, I tried so many different things to get through this film. I smoked a joint. That didn't work. I drank 2 bottles of wine. That didn't work. People are like, they're like, I tried so hard and I just couldn't watch it because I just hated it so much.
But I had the same impression when I went on Letterboxd. I was like, oh, this is a very love or hate it film.
Yeah.
And because I didn't feel too strongly about it either way, I was like, I know Charlie's going to like it. I'm worried Katie's going to hate it, but I'm okay with her hating it because that's the discussion that this film invites, is what I told Charlie.
Do you like it less than you like Stolen Kisses when you came on the Graduate episode?
I was thinking about that earlier.
You're just going to rag on Francesco's pitch.
There is a fundamental problem here, which is that I just have like zero grounding in French cinema. A lot of grounding in musical theatre and to a lesser extent opera. So I'm like completely coming at it from the angle of what have you done to this thing that I love with no appreciation at all for a tradition that I don't understand. You know what I mean? Like, so I think that's a...
If the Sparks Brothers or the Ocaracs are listening...
We're sorry.
Add this to the tagline of Annette. What did you do to this thing that I love? Because that's what this film is.
To be fair, that's narratively accurate.
As a final comic, I just realized, I just find it interesting that we're talking so much about the Sparks Brothers and not really too much about Leo Carac, who is someone who has incredible control over his projects. I don't know if either of you have seen Holy Motors or Lovers on the Bridge or any of his films, but I just find it interesting that, like, just the presence of the Sparks Brothers, and because probably so many of your problems are with the music itself, that a lot of our comments are, you know, addressed to them. But, you know, like, Carax, if you watch Holy Motors, they will explain kind of like, oh, this is what these people's sense of humor is. They just, they're very, like, out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll check out Holy Motors and then maybe revisit Annette. I think you were probably correct in predicting that I would like this film.
Yeah.
Because you know the kind of weirdness I'm into at this point. Good joke's on you, I'm into that.
And also, sorry, as a final comment, for the people who know Carax, have seen Holy Motors, haven't seen this film yet, the same way that Holy Motors feels like a exploration and indictment of the evolution of cinema as a language from slapstick to CGI and things like this. This film, it's almost exploring the idea of the digital world, there are these interspersed segments of news cycles.
Like, which looks like, so fake. And
like,
it's
trashy,
really funny.
Like, gossipy news cycles covering their relationship. And it's kind of exploring the current media landscape and deconstructing it in a way that I don't think is as interesting and deep as Holy Motors, but it's nevertheless there. So Carax is in this film, I promise. He's not absent.
Well, he is literally in this film.
Is he?
He's in the opening song.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Everyone is.
He goes the lovely voiceover telling you not to... like, have any human functions and says, yeah, don't breathe. I loved that. I was really excited at the start of the film when he said breathing will not
you
be
hate
out.
Breathing.
I hate breathing.
And the very, before the film even starts, there's a clip, a sound, a barely audible sound clip that's been played. That is the very first sound ever recorded on tape in the history of sound recording. And I think that was Carax's insertion there, because I don't think the rest of the film is as ambitious as trying to be about the history of sound, but that's the kind of nerdy thing that Carax would be into.
So, should we talk availability?
Yeah.
All right, you can stream this on Mubi, you can rent and buy it on Amazon, Sky Store, Apple TV. Oh, and what's this? Katie, can you read this one for us?
Rakuten.
No.
No, Katie. You fool. It is the elite streaming service, Rakuten TV. We're going for 2 for 3. You reckon we can make it? No, of course it won't. TikTok won't be available on Rakuten TV. It's a
Netflix
film.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Rakuten TV.
But we're hoping to get a sponsorship by them because we're doing way more marketing for them than they are.
Maybe I shouldn't have told them to go fuck themselves. For the brand.
For the brand. So on to the next film.
But because we're all worn out and these two are about to fight, we think we should chill and make some pancakes.
Pancakes.
Hello. Hi. Welcome. I'm Jonathan Larson. I am 29 years old. I work at the Moondance Diner.
Check.
One sec. Do we take reservations? No, we do not take... We're a diner. I have an original rock musical.
Hey, boy genius.
That I have spent the last 8 years of my life writing.
He's getting out. You're going to be rich and famous.
And rewriting.
Did you crack it yet?
Oh, I'm getting so close.
And rewriting.
Can I hear it?
Any day now.
8 years!
And the time keeps ticking. Tick, tick.
You need to ask, are you letting yourself be led by fear or by love?
Fear! 100% fear!
The pancakes were a mistake. I've forgotten how to speak.
So this is the last section of the podcast, and it's the first one post-pancakes.
Tick, Tick, Boom is a 2021 film directed by Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame. On the cusp of his 30th birthday, Jonathan Larson, a promising young theatre composer, navigates love, friendship, and the pressure to create something great before time runs out. So, this is a musical film. This is a proper musical. This is, in a way, it's a posthumous biopic written by its own subject, because Jonathan Larson, the very real composer of the musical Rent, as well as Tick, Tick, Boom, has given himself a rock autobiography. And in some ways, I guess, self-appointed successor Lin-Manuel Miranda has decided to make his feature debut by adapting this musical monologue into a film. A film I really like.
I really like it too. I did not expect to like it. This is the second time I watched it, but the first time I watched it, I was kind of dreading it because I was still in a withdrawal from Lin Mania.
Mm.
You know, after Hamilton and, you know, being on SNL and being like on every
chat show. A lot of overexposure.
Yeah, and also Moana, which I also really like. But turns out this guy really knows how to make musicals work on screen, and it was very exciting that he did. I thought it was really cool, and I also think Andrew Garfield was fantastic. He was just sort of emanating the right sort of theatre kid energy.
Big theatre kid energy.
Everyone in this film has big theatre kid energy.
Absolutely.
But it works for the film. And also, Andrew Garfield, you know, just one of the best Jews.
Who's the best Jew?
Pardon?
If it's one of the best, who's the best?
Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks, okay.
I think that's fair.
I was about to say Jesus, but...
Okay, that's... You can have him.
Oh, God.
We did take him.
Who's the best Italian?
Don't say Roberto Benigni. Dante Alighieri.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yes.
Mm. Katie, what's the best basic-ass white woman?
Rachel Bloom.
She's Jewish.
She is Jewish. As I said that, I was like, damn it, fuck, someone else.
So, Well, things that we're not going to cut.
we're going to keep all this.
Yeah, I enjoyed it more than I expected. So I'm not the biggest fan of Rent and not the biggest fan of Hamilton. In a way, there is a case to be made that Hamilton is a form of a spiritual successor of Rent for all the wrong reasons. But I ended up surprisingly liking this. It feels more like Jonathan Larson's voice as, you know, unfiltered through a commercial lens and more, you know, him just talking about himself. Just considering a line in the film that his agent tells him, oh, try and write more about yourself and try and write less, you know, ambitious musicals. And
he's like, no, fuck that. I'm going to write about the first US Secretary of the Treasury.
No, but that's
later. Jonathan Larson writes Hamilton. And has great success. And never dies.
Rent, you know, it's kind of a...
This was meant to be the cool down.
We had pancakes.
We didn't have like LSD. They're pancakes.
Did we have speed? Did any of us have speed? Did any of us go to Beef's locker room? Changing room.
We had pancakes with Beef. That was the problem.
Jonathan Larson is a spiritual successor to Beef.
But it's obviously it's such an interesting
Oh, I'd love that.
I think he could.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's such an interesting pick to Moulin Rouge because Moulin Rouge, to get back on topic, is
God bless you.
It's an operatic adaptation. It's an adaptation of La Traviata, but according to Baz Luhrmann, it was heavily and most of all inspired by La Bohème. Mm. And Rent, it's basically a baby adaptation of La Bohème.
Yeah. There is literally a song called La Vie Bohème.
Yeah.
And there's a song in this called Boho Days.
Can't get away from the Bohème. And their vague, unspecified revolutions.
I mean, what is it about just like white middle class men love saying that they're Bohemian?
It's the Grand Tour. It's literally, it's Byron. It's just like, I went on holiday and now I'm interesting.
I went to Asia.
From the beginning of European men.
Isn't it crazy that like you have to go to Asia to discover yourself now? And Byron was so busy, he just like went to Greece.
I love it in Bridgerton when they're like, oh my God, Colin, you're going to Greece? To Greece?
But I do think it's interesting that both this and Moulin Rouge take from La Bohème, which was written in a very specific historical setting where, you know...
You're doing so well.
You're doing so well. You're like a babysitter.
Sorry, substitute teacher, keep us on track.
So La Bohème by Giacomo Puccini was written in a very specific historical setting where Bohemia wasn't a political act per se. Well, it was like basically the idea of like, we're gonna live lavishly libertine lives. And that's what Tick, Tick, Boom and Moulin Rouge are about. Rent tries to make it more explicitly political and fails. Elvis kind of does the same as I mentioned earlier. And it's, you know, it's not about actually engaging in political revolution and changing the system. What these kids care about is writing musicals and drinking and having fun. And, you know, I think this film makes it a bit clearer that Jonathan Larson isn't actually changing the world or changing the system or doesn't necessarily want to.
Well, this is a question I have about the film and its opinion. And it doesn't need to be clear-cut, and most of the best films don't necessarily have a thesis. But there's that scene right about in the middle of the film where he accuses his friend Michael, who is played by...
Someone I don't know.
Robin de Jesus,
who's really good.
Oh, so brilliant.
And really adorable in this film. And he basically calls his friend a sellout, and he says, you're writing musicals, you're not saving the fucking rainforest.
Yeah, it's that perfect. He's like, you're writing musicals in your living room, you're not saving the rainforest. It's such a gorgeous reading of the line as
but
well.
But my question is that does the film agree with Michael or Jonathan? Because it does sort of venerate Jonathan Larson. It does sort of say that his work did change musical theatre. It doesn't say change the world and stopped all its evils, but it does hold him up. So I guess having articulated now, I feel like I have an answer that I want to put to you and see if you guys agree. It's saying that, yeah, Broadway is a closed off community. Look at all the cameos that are in this movie. This is a film about us. For us, for the people that see Broadway, for the people who are in Broadway, and this person is important to us. He doesn't have to change the world because he meant something to me, the filmmaker Lin-Manuel Miranda, and to us, the people who are in this film and love his work. Do you think that's the close thing to a thesis it might have?
I think that's a huge part of it. And I think, yeah, it's that thing of, you know, we talk about, you know, we give license to the paradise. You're like, well, you're not playing a game where interrogating the realism of these people is relevant, you know. And I guess there are some, there's that we could have endless conversations about art, about making art, right? Like there's, you know, inevitably it can feel self-indulgent, or it can feel very, you know, the final season of Game of Thrones, my reference point for all bad things, being like, stories are the most important thing in the world. And it's like, okay, well, yes, you're a professional writer, but like, can we make it more complicated than that? At the end of the day, story is the most important thing we have. And you're like,
it would have been more sense if that was Jonathan Larson and not Bran, who has never told a fucking story in eight seasons.
No, he just knows a lot of stories that he specifically doesn't tell people.
And that's why no one wants to produce his show.
But it's that thing of like, yeah, this matters to us. I'm making a film about a person and this is the film's central character. So yeah, we're going to really care about what he cares about. And it doesn't have to be that that's the most important thing in the world. It is the most important thing to him. And also it's, I think, I don't know, that kind of coda of like, he did, you know, I'm doing heavy air quotes, change what a musical could be. But you're like, you know, this is a film about potential and the fear of dying and the very rational fear of dying when you're surrounded by death. And you know already that this is a film about someone who dies really, really young. It's, you know, it's a question of potential. And it's this slightly odd thing of like, oh, he really succeeded, but he was dead, which is such a classic, tragic, operatic,
artistic
thing.
But it's also a film about a guy whose friends, who are all dying young, tell him, stop bitching, you're not going to die young. And then he does die young.
Yeah, that's a slightly weird gotcha, isn't it? It's quite uncomfortable.
And like, in that moment, you're on their side. But in like, with the benefit of hindsight, you are just like, is this movie trying to be like, yeah, you... victims of HIV, you got it wrong. He did die. Gotcha.
It's because he wrote it. I think if he hadn't written it and someone out, and Lin-Manuel Miranda had written this musical called Tick Tick Boom, and there was this sense of time running out, you'd be like, that's a bit, you're laying it on a bit thick. Like, I mean, people don't know they're going to die.
That's exactly what Hamilton does.
But he wrote it. So he really wrote all of that stuff, all of that music that's so about my time is running out.
Did he write it before or after he died?
What? Yeah. He wrote it before he died.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then he didn't know. Okay.
Yeah. It's not a three-eyed raven situation.
From beyond the grave. So he's writing with this sense of like that, you know, whatever spirituality. Sorry, I'm completely thrown off.
It's like such an innocuous joke, and it just threw you for a loop.
I thought you were saying it as a joke, and then you looked at me like you were expecting an answer, and I was like, I don't want to answer earnestly. Okay, like,
finish your point.
I have no idea what it was. something, a sense of his own mortality, something, what do we know about our imminent deaths?
The message of Tick Tick Boom, the musical that he wrote, was, I was so in my head about not achieving my potential, and I was wrong. I'm just at the beginning of my career.
Mm.
And then the film says, but he died.
But that's the thing.
I didn't mean to laugh at that. I'm just saying that, like...
That was, yeah, it was an uncomfortable laugh.
But like the anvil of that. But he did die, so this whole... Everything he said is... He was right, but he became wrong.
But that's the thing, like, if you watch this as someone who's in the same spot as him, you know, aspiring writer in the early 30s, which message do you agree with? Like,
it depends if you're dead or not.
It doesn't really feel like... I guess I'm maybe I just read something slightly different from it. It doesn't really feel like it's a message thing. It just made me feel quite seen. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't really about whether or not he's right to have those feelings or he's right about his potential. It was just like, it's very relatable to be staring down the age of 30 and be like, am I going to be the person I thought I was going to be?
Yeah.
Because I thought I might have become them by now.
So in a way, Jonathan Larson is the Bo Burnham of his day. Just give a chaos joke. But look, so to go back, because I meant to answer your previous question, there's a line where he's speaking to Michael and he's basically like admitting, I give up, I want to have a day job, you know, a corporate day job like you. And Michael replies, no, you shouldn't, because you can't waste away the gift that you have. And that's something that doesn't sit too right with me, and Rand does it as well. The two things are mutually exclusive. You can have a day job and write art. Obviously, a day job will suck a lot of time out of you, that if you didn't have that, you'd be able to, you know, write and produce so much more. But that's the sad reality of why a lot of people who become successful artists young are rich and don't need to work, probably, and can invest the time in it.
He does have a day job. He works at the diner. He's not talking about having a day job while he writes. He's talking about not writing anymore and committing.
That's true.
To a career.
The day job he will get is like the most like vile.
I don't think he's talking about getting a day job. He's talking about giving up on writing.
Yeah. And it's not what they're talking about. Yeah, and it's not like it's bad for you to have a day job, bad for you to have a career. It is, I know that this will destroy you personally.
Mm. And as your friend, not as a stand-in for any greater comment, specifically as your friend, I'm telling you not to give up on your dreams because you're talented.
Exactly. And there is sort of like two olive branches, which is a way for him to maybe slightly compromise, and one is to move to the Berkshires with Susan, and he can still write. Maybe it's different in the time before Zoom, but you know,
they got phones.
Yeah, exactly. Like he could still write and do stuff there, but he so much like wants to be part of that world. And Michael isn't saying be like me. He's saying, you know, you can make some money writing ads, like writing music for ads, and you'd still be writing, so you'd still have the energetic part of your mind working while you do this other stuff. At least that's how I read it. But then when he comes in, it's him coming in desperation, wanting to throw everything away rather than compromise a little to make a bit more money or not live in a terrible city where everything is extremely expensive.
And there's a brilliant scene of the focus group where they're asked to pitch a slogan for a product, and he completely enamors the marketing person who's running the focus group.
Who's Laura Benanti, the Broadway star. Okay. This film is over so far. The Broadway star.
But I love that he wins her over by using his quote-unquote creativity, but he expresses it through giving the most generic possible, like, regurgitated Americana imagery. But then they are so, you know, like, he's a performer and he's good at what he does, and they're so taken by his performance and they're so taken by his ability to perform, and they clearly value it, although he's purposely like doing a corporatized, sanitized version of what he likes to do. And then they want to channel that into writing a slogan for a horrible, like,
It's the full details
of the drug thing. Yeah.
And you're like,
And that is such a, you know, it's very on the nose, but it was such a funny critique of the way that, you know, the corporate world absorbs creativity onto itself and just stifles it, which I think is what, Michael is addressing. It is more of what Michael is addressing when he's telling him not to take a day job in the company.
Because Michael's not a writer.
Yeah.
Like, Michael doesn't need to write. He was an actor and wasn't as into it as Jonathan was, and he's very honest about that and honest with himself about that, whereas Jonathan is someone that is 100% committed to not only being successful but being important.
Now, I think I was projecting the problems I have with Rent onto this film. I need to separate them
Maybe project the things that you like about this film onto Rent.
That did help me.
Because you were saying off mic that it unlocked, especially the way that it portrays, you know, the HIV epidemic.
It's always the things that recently I've kind of found myself liking Rent a bit more again is because I found it so, I think it's really frustrating that it's like still kind of the, you know, there's one or two big like AIDS crisis musicals, and I just don't think Rent should really be one, because it isn't really very honestly about that crisis. It's not from a queer perspective. Like, it's very much about what's it like to be a straight person with friends who are being affected by this crisis. Obviously, I know that the characters are, you know, it's from drug use and it's like lots of communities are affected by that, but it's very much from the perspective of, you know, Mark, the guy who's like, oh, my parents love me so much, they call me all the time and want to help me out with things, and I can leave this world whenever I choose. And that's always, and you know, the straight couple are really the focus of it, and it's Mimi who gets saved rather than Angel, and it's, you know, it's just, I think, I have no idea how revolutionary and groundbreaking it might have been in 1990. I wish that it wasn't still seen as like some kind of definitive text from about that.
1996 by the time it came out, so I don't know.
Already
had a few years to re-examine the past.
I mean, it wasn't past, but it was still happening.
Yeah, but Tick Tick Boom is set in 1989.
It's 1990.
Right. And there is a line in Tick Tick Boom where Michael, once again, the voice of reason in this entire film, expressly says that, oh no, the epidemic has been exacerbated by the government. As far as I can recall, there's none of that in Rent.
No, it's it's just as you said before, off mic, like it's very sanitized and it's got this oddly corporate vibe to it. But seeing it through the lens of this film and reading it as much more a case of, yeah, this is this straight boy trying to be an artist who's probably got more options than he's letting on or admitting to himself, but really is living through this time in terms of how what he's watching happen to his friends, and he's trying to make sense of it, and he's trying to do something, and what he does is write musicals. Suddenly I was so much more sympathetic to it as a text. And I think, you know, musicals that you grow up with, that you kind of feel like they've always existed, because they have, you know, in my lifetime.
It's a lullaby.
That's my phone telling me it's time to go to bed.
You go to bed at 10:15?
No, it's telling me that I have to go to bed at 11 and wind down. Okay. Anyway, seeing it through that lens of a real person wrote this about a time he was living in and about his friends. And yes, he centres kind of himself and maybe caters to what an audience might accept. I have just so much more interest in that musical when I think about it through that. So yeah. I guess I feel like the film gives me an insight into him as a writer and as a person that allows me to hold that other more famous piece in a slightly different way.
Yeah,
that's quite appreciated.
He's following his own advice of writing about himself, the things that he actually knows and he experienced.
And to be honest, from just taking that advice of what his agent tells him to write, you know, about your own experiences, it almost makes it seem like it would have been more disingenuous to write Rent from the point of view of a queer person.
Mm. Yeah, that he is centering what he knows and his perspective. And I just, so then I'm like, okay, what I want is I just want there to be more queer people making art and having that level of success about their own experiences. It's not his fault.
Well, no,
nothing's his fault. He died before the show opened. Like,
he's a guy that wrote a musical. He's not.
Yeah,
he's
exactly,
like,
exactly. None of that is on him.
In 1996, or like Rent has, you know, it's taken a while to write that as well. You know, early 90s. Obviously, if anyone was going to make a big musical about AIDS, it was going to be a straight guy. I'm sorry,
there was not
a platform for queer people to write.
It's not that they didn't have a platform, because, you know, Broadway's been very welcoming to queer people, unlike a lot of other spaces. It's more the fact that, and to put it crudely, they were all dying.
Yeah,
like, there weren't enough of them.
And in terms of young writers, they had other things to worry about, maybe more so than furthering their writing career
and making it about the horrible thing that was happening to them and their friends and could happen to them.
Let's not forget about the huge amount of art that was made about AIDS by queer people during the late 80s and early 90s that it simply didn't explode as much as Rent. But once again, that's not Jonathan Larson's fault. He wasn't even aware of that.
I have two things. One, the way that, so I think the problem you have about sort of the ubiquity of Rent is sort of, I wonder if it's subtly referenced in this film by the references to Cats, the idea of the mega musical, and the fact that it's directed by the writer of Hamilton.
Oh, and also I think that Hamilton did such a rapid journey from, oh my god, revolutionary, changing the art form, you know, young upstart,
to Ariana DeBose at the BAFTAs.
Yeah, total establishment, you know, status, that's happened so quickly. It's been like 8 years.
The second thing is, the other musical, you said one of two, you know, musicals dealing explicitly with the AIDS crisis, are you referring to Falsettos as the other one, which I love?
Yeah, and that's not just about, like, that's very explicitly and specifically also about Jewishness. It's not just about the AIDS crisis.
But I mean, Jonathan Larson is, you know, Jewish, and he refers to the Mourners Kaddish, and also Angels in America is explicitly Jewish. There is, you know, an interesting confluence in, you know, queer writers writing about, I mean, Jonathan Larson obviously wasn't queer, but the confluence of particularly the emphasis on mourning in Jewishness that resonated a lot with me. And, you know, obviously this terrible, terrible thing that happens and is still happening, just we don't talk about it as much because it's not happening as much in our backyard.
Okay, so back on track. Was there anything
do you
else?
Have any more thoughts, or can we just...
Oh, we just mentioned Alexandra Shipp is amazing.
Vanessa Hudgens is
also amazing.
She's amazing.
And just, you're like, oh, wow, no matter like what you're doing, even in a small role, you are still a movie star.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
And I think basically the thing that, and the reason that I picked this, besides the obvious thing about, you know, sad boy just wants to share his art with the world, beautiful lady sings, there is mysterious death in the artistic underworld. But I just love a musical that is happy to be a musical. I love it when a musical film is like, what fun we get to have, that there will be singing and there will be dancing and we have cameras, so we can look at those things in a way that we wouldn't manage to do on stage, rather than being like, oh God, we've got to do singing. How do we make the singing not embarrassing? Maybe if we make it really bad, people won't be embarrassed.
But I think what you said is especially true of musicals that use cinematic techniques such as, you know, CGI, and, you know, have celebratory songs about how much the characters love each other. So,
but those were the waves internet were my favorite thing in the whole of the piece. And like when the baby, this is what, when the puppet baby floats and sings.
I think I mentioned that. Yeah.
I'm like, lovely. Yeah, fine.
We didn't say for Tick Tick Boom favorite number.
Therapy.
Oh, Therapy is really good.
Like, I've seen it done badly. I've also seen Lin-Manuel Miranda do it badly. It's the way they do it here is so good, and it's so the way that it's intercut, it's so well edited. It's I love it. I love that scene.
I really do love 3090, the opening number.
Is that just because you're how old are you now?
I'm very young. I'm 27.
Oh, you're only a year older than me. I wanted to gap you.
But I just really love that song. But I also really love Why, when he goes and he finds the piano in the park and he kind of goes through his journey.
I love the closing number as well.
Yeah.
It's very emotional.
It's really good.
Boho Days is very theater kid, but it's a cappella, but
it's
like
fun.
It.
Yeah. Joshua Henry's having a great time in this film. He's having a lovely, lovely time. He's in Boho Days, and he's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's just, it's like, what's happened?
I love Joshua Henry's friend who's in finance. He turns up to the first
My God, yeah, who comes to everything.
He's so relatable.
We need those people.
They buy drugs.
They buy tickets, more importantly. Shout out
Jonathan
to my
Larson,
real jobs.
Not a nice party host. He was just I think he was rude to that guy.
I'm the future of musical theatre.
That guy's hilarious. He was like, no one in their right mind would ever say that and mean it. Yeah. That guy must be insane. Oh God. Okay, availability?
Netflix.
Cool.
It's a Netflix movie.
All right. So you know how this goes. If we like the Moulin Rouge as main course, what film is dessert? I want to go first and put my beef down. Mm-hmm. It's Phantom of the Paradise.
If you love musicals, it's Tick Tick Boom. If you hate musicals, it's Annette. If you love music and you love yourself, it's Phantom of the Paradise.
Sublime. If I've already watched Moulin Rouge, then it's Tick Tick Boom. There were a good 35 minutes of Annette that I loved.
In a
two-and-a-half-hour movie. Yeah. That's not bad. I could hate
a lot
it
of movies
a lot
have
more.
Less.
I just hated the first hour a lot, and then I sort of alternately was bored and or was moved and laughed during the second half.
If you have to choose between rewatching Annette and rewatching Nine, which one would you choose?
Oh, God, why would you do this to me? how long is Nine? What's the running
too
time?
It is much shorter. It's too long because it exists.
it would be more interesting to watch Annette a second time than it would be to watch Nine again.
I think it'd be interesting to watch Annette a second time.
I would get more.
Nine is 112 minutes and Annette is 140. It's nearly half an hour longer.
Yeah. But I really don't think I would gain anything by watching Nine again, whereas I do think it would at least be interesting to watch Annette again.
I think Annette is a fun movie and you can watch it next to Moulin Rouge if you're into formalism and maximalism and just films that are a little bit cartoony and crazy and out there. It's not as audience friendly as Moulin Rouge. So.
But with enough absinthe, anything is possible.
Oh my God, watch Annette on absinthe. On 19th century absinthe, which actually gave you hallucinations.
Of Kylie Minogue dressed as Tinkerbell.
And you know that she does a quick scream, that's Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, amazing.
And listen to Sparks, they're really good.
Yeah, they're a good band.
Yeah.
Quite famous. I'd like to thank our producer, Jade Corbett. Thank Molecule for our artwork. You can follow us on Twitter at BCU Watch Pod, and you can follow us on Instagram at BCU Watch Podcast. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people follow you and what can they follow?
They can follow me at KTC Patterson on most social medias. You can also follow at SideFXPlay if you want to make like Charlie and come do audience participation.
Or if you just want to watch it and not get on stage like an idiot.
That's also allowed.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening.